Welcome to episode 43 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm John Hickner, also a family physician and editor-in-chief of the Journal of Family Practice.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems.
On this podcast, we highlight POEMS, which stands for Patient-Oriented Evidence That Matters. If you want all of the POEMS, subscribe to Essential Evidence, where you get a POEM every day, plus a great primary care reference with over 800 disease and symptom chapters, thousands of interactive decision support tools. Check it out at EssentialEvidencePlus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. So, last time we covered six or seven brief updates on COVID-19. It's still on our minds, and we've got a couple to start off with on this podcast. And then we'll have a couple of our standard POEMS, one on breast cancer and one on heart disease, because we're still managing patients with other conditions, often at a distance, but we're still wanting to keep you up to date on those matters. So the first one was a Cochrane collaboration, a Cochrane review. They published what they call a rapid review April 8th, 2020. They included 29 studies in their systematic review that included 10 modeling studies of COVID-19, 4 observational studies, and 15 modeling studies of SARS or MERS. And what they found was that quarantine measures are consistently effective in dampening the spread of an epidemic. Quarantine is most effective when it's implemented early. Yeah, that makes sense. And in conjunction with other public health measures like closing schools, restricting travel, social distancing. The Ohio Department of Health just released a really cool little PSA illustrating why social distancing can work. So if you go to YouTube, Ohio Department of Health, COVID-19, it involves mousetraps and ping pong balls, and it's kind of fun to watch. So a good way of educating the public, I think. And that's a big part of this is the adherence. We can have all the mandates we want, but if adherence is poor, then there's going to be less of an impact. Another report in JAMA, April 10th, by Pan and colleagues out of Wuhan, China, it reported the basic reproductive number for patients in a series of time periods during which restrictions on public gathering and emphasis on distancing was increased and intensified. So this basic reproductive number, it's also called R-naught. It's the average number of persons infected by an infected case. It began around 3.0 before public measures were put into place. And by the time they had all of the measures rolled out, it was down to 0.3. So really dampened that reproductive number. And locally, we've been tracking here, Georgia has 155 counties, I think it's 155. And so lots and lots of small counties. And Clark is the smallest county in Georgia, where I live in Athens, Georgia. And we're surrounded by 6 rural counties that are also relatively small in population. And what I've been doing is tracking new cases in Clark, where we implemented this distancing very early, around March 17th, compared to the rest of the state, where they implemented it April 1st. And what you see is a few days after the implementation here, 4 or 5 days, our doubling time, which is sort of the inverse of the reproductive number. It's basically the you want a higher doubling time. That's the number of days it takes for the number of cases to double. And what we found was that the doubling time immediately started going up. It's now over 15. It began at 2.5. So it was doubling every 2.5 days. It's now at 15. Whereas in the surrounding counties, they didn't start going up till 5 days after the governor's order on April 1st, and they're still only at a doubling time of 5 or 6 days. So the early intensive action here in Clark County really seems to have made a difference, and I think illustrates the value of distancing with good adherence. Guys?
I have been comparing Michigan with the state of South Dakota because that's where my wife is from, and looking at the difference in a state that they did not implement strict social distancing really at all. It's been mostly voluntary. And looking at the projections for total number of cases, especially the case rates, although Michigan will have more cases because it's a bigger state, it looks like the rate of cases per person in South Dakota, in fact, the death rate, will probably end up being twice that of the state of Michigan. So there's further evidence that the early social distancing measures make a difference.
Yeah, we're going to see a ton of data coming out because we have all these natural experiments going on really in an unprecedented way to be able to study this and, you know, look at the impact of specific measures, because we also have school closures and university closures occurring before mandatory distancing. So you can really start to see what these impacts are. Henry, any comment?
Yeah, so I think this pandemic is going to give epistemologists things to write about for decades. You think about some of the prevailing theories under which people operate. One common is empiricism, which basically means that your knowledge about things arises only from the things that you directly observe. And this, you know, you think about Locke and Bacon as proponents of this. You know, we have many politicians who won't believe until they see it themselves. You know, the opposite of that is rationalism, which allows you to actually use your mind as a source of knowledge. And that's, you know, espoused by Descartes and Leibniz. Descartes, you know, je pense, donc je suis. You know, I think, therefore I am. And then there's, you know, an additional prevailing theme, which I think you hear imbued in us, which is skepticism, which questions the certitude in knowledge. And frankly, I think what we need is the harmonious blend of all of these things. And we can't just focus purely on empiricism during this kind of a crisis.
Henry, wow, you're going off philosophical on us. Man, I was wondering, who is this guy? I never knew you were that smart, Henry. Jeez, that's impressive. All right. Well, very well spoken. And Locke and Hobbes, that was the movie that just came out. Oh. And Bacon is what I'm going to have for breakfast tomorrow. Thank you. and more from Henry. We've got the quiz now, too.
All right. So which of the following terms is applied to the practice of isolating persons confirmed to have a communicable disease from the healthy population? A, quarantine. B, social isolation. C, medical isolation. D, protective isolation. Stay tuned.
So all of the above isn't an option.
No.
Okay. All right, Henry, it's your turn as well for the poem. And about going to tell us a little bit about extended follow-up with anastrozole in women with breast cancer.
Yeah. So this is from the IBIS-2 study that asks the question, in women at increased risk of breast cancer, does a 5-year course of anastrozole or Arimidex decrease the risk of breast cancer in long term? And this was just published in Lancet just a few weeks ago. The initial 5-year follow-up, about 1% of women who received this aromatase inhibitor had invasive breast cancer, compared to about 3% of those who were treated with a placebo. That translated into a number needed to treat of about 63 for 5 years. And what happened in this is that they tried to follow up the women, maintaining the blinding so that people still didn't know who was taking what. Now, the increased risk, these were all postmenopausal women, and they used some really sophisticated age stratifications to determine what the population norms were, a lot more than we could go into in a podcast. But they really did a very sophisticated job to identify women who are at high risk. They followed these women for a subsequent, a median of about 11 to 12 years. And what they found was that there was an additional 1.5% of women who were on anastrozole who developed invasive breast cancer, compared with about 2.5% of those who are on placebo. It works out to a number needed to treat of about 83. So if you take it from the very beginning to the very end, over that entire study duration, the total rate of invasive breast cancer was about 4.5% versus 8.5% respectively. So that translates actually into a number needed to treat of about 25. And now that was the good news. Now there's some sobering news, and that is that overall mortality and breast cancer mortality were similar. Now there may have been low rates to that. And at the at the end of the follow-up, there were a few higher rates of things like venous thromboembolic phenomena and the like, but the numbers were so small that they didn't really reach statistical significance. So, there are always some, we always try to balance the benefits and harms. This was a relatively small study. I don't remember the exact numbers. But functionally, what we end up with is the certainly a lot of benefit in terms of women who are at high risk for developing breast cancer.
Yeah, certainly a number needed to treat of 25 is pretty impressive. But what about mortality? This was incidence. Now, did they look at mortality? Do you know?
Yeah, they looked. So overall mortality and breast cancer specific mortality were not affected.
Okay, not even trends, just not affected. What about tolerability? I mean, how well tolerated were these medicines in the women?
Yeah, in the short term, these were generally fairly well tolerated in terms of side effects. In terms of major events, there was a trend to the higher rates.
Yeah, okay, good stuff. John, any comments?
Yes, recall that the USPSTF recently revised their guidelines for prophylaxis for breast cancer in high-risk women in a more encouraging way, I would say. That is, you really should consider this. But my whole problem with this is, despite the decent number needed to treat of 25, what that means is that only 4% of these women who take the drug are likely to benefit from it. And there are some real side effects of the drugs. And because there's no difference in mortality, even breast cancer specific mortality, it seems to me the alternative of just keeping up with your yearly mammograms and being very careful is as good an alternative. So I'm not surprised that this idea has really not taken off in primary care practice.
Yeah, this definitely is something that should be a shared decision and is something that, whenever you're balancing benefits and harms is the case. And I think the uptake of chemo prevention for breast cancer has been pretty low overall. And these drugs are a little better tolerated, I think, than tamoxifen, but still, and that may help with the uptake, but still the overall uptake is quite low. Henry?
Yeah, so recall that we also have tamoxifen that you mentioned and raloxifene, and I'd love to see somebody do a little head-to-head analysis, maybe a network meta-analysis, comparing this tolerability and effectiveness of the various agents.
Yeah, there was a direct comparison between, I think it was the Ruth trial, might have been, or maybe a different one. In any case, it was comparing tamoxifen with raloxifene directly, and it looked like there might have been a slightly greater benefit to the tamoxifen, but fewer adverse effects with the raloxifene. So, and it was, that was an older trial as well. So, yeah, I think ideally we'd like to see a direct head-to-head comparison. In the absence of that, maybe we'll do a network meta-analysis. John, I think you're going to tell us about a really surprising study to do with MI.
Yes, indeed. The clinical question was, does treatment with colchicine after myocardial infarction prevent recurrent cardiovascular events? This was published in New England Journal of Medicine 2019, volume 381, starting on page 2497, if you'd like to look it up. We do know that inflammation plays a role in heart attacks. In this trial, the investigators evaluated the role of colchicine in lowering the risk of ischemic cardiovascular events in patients with recent MIs, and colchicine does have some anti-inflammatory effect. They randomized 4,745 patients who had had an MI within the last 30 days and who had completed any planned revascularization procedures. They either received colchicine, 0.5 milligrams daily, or placebo. They excluded those with severe heart failure, severe hepatic or renal disease, recent stroke, or recent bypass surgery. Now, the endpoint was the so-called MACE, major adverse cardiac events, which is a composite, which of course we don't particularly like, but nonetheless, a composite of important cardiovascular events, including death from a cardiovascular cause, resuscitation from cardiac arrest, MI, stroke, or urgent hospitalization for angina leading to coronary revascularization. The two groups were similar at baseline. The mean age was 61, and almost all were also treated with dual antiplatelet therapy and a statin. So these patients were on good treatment. The median follow-up was 23 months, and the patients received colchicine or placebo for a median of 19 months. Here are the results. 5.5% of the patients in the colchicine group had a cardiovascular event compared to 7.1% in the placebo group, which gives us a number needed to treat of 63, which is not bad, especially over the course of less than 2 years. The result was primarily driven by a decrease in stroke. The number needed to treat for stroke was 167, and a decrease in urgent hospitalizations for angina leading to revascularization, where the number needed to treat was 100. Concerning adverse events, the colchicine group reported more nausea and flatulence, which is not a big deal than the control, and had a slightly higher rate of pneumonia, but the incident was quite low at any rate, only 1% versus 0.5%. So the bottom line here is that daily colchicine after MI reduces cardiovascular events, specifically strokes and coronary revascularizations. The drug is relatively inexpensive. If you look at GoodRx, the generic goes for $155 a month or $55 if you have a coupon. And it is widely available. And it's well tolerated and certainly should be considered for patients who've had a recent MI who are already on guideline-directed therapy. To me, this seems like a practice changer. What do you think, Henry?
Well, this is a really old-timey drug. It was approved by the FDA back in 1961. But in fact, we've probably got over 3,000 years worth of colchicine experience going back to the use of the autumn crocus that for the treatment of painfully swollen joints. But, you know, frankly, I've got a bone to pick with you. You know, in the previous poem, you said that a number needed to treat of 25 wasn't all that impressive. And yet here you're touting a number needed to treat of 63 as maybe being a pretty good idea.
Oh, I'm getting boxed in here, Mark. Help me out, Mark.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's the number needed to treat what? You know, is it? And in this case, I think the adverse effects really are not that major, although the, you know, friends and partners of the patient flatulent may disagree. But, you know, but on the other hand, the harms of the Arimidex were, you know, VTE and other more serious things. So I think that may be partly what Henry's getting at. And just the tolerability of the Arimidex and these aromatase inhibitors for lots of folks. But yeah, I thought this was fascinating, unexpected. I wonder if it's going to change practice. I wonder if folks are going to wait for another study to come out. But you know, it seems like, and plus if you want, I just was thinking about this, if it's $150 here a month, over a year, you can take your $1,500 and buy a plane ticket to the UK and then buy a year's worth for $100 over there and then fly back. Maybe that, cause I think it's $10 a month in the UK, or maybe you just drive across the border to Canada if you're up there.
A new idea for medical tourism.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that what happened was colchicine got a special dispensation to, because they finally did a trial of gout. And so they said, you can have a patent protection for 2 years, and they jacked up the price astronomically, Colchris. And so, but we still can still get the generic. That cost has gone way up because it makes it look better than the Colchris at least. But yeah, good one to consider. $50 a month. Isn't that bad? And you know, I think it's, the results are pretty impressive. Time for the answer to the quiz, Henry.
All right. So the question was, which of the following terms is applied to the practice of isolating persons confirmed to have a communicable disease from the healthy population? A, quarantine. B, social isolation. C, medical isolation. D, protective isolation. Well, the correct term is medical isolation. And we have to contrast that with the term quarantine, which actually we apply when we take persons or goods that have actually been exposed but don't have any evidence of the disease. And then we isolate them for some period of time to get past the incubation period. In some ways, if you think of quarantine as being analogous to universal precaution, since we basically have to assume that an infection exists until proven otherwise. It turns out that the term quarantine originates in ancient Venice, where ships were isolated for 40 days before passengers and crew could go ashore to prevent the spreading of Black Death. And the practice, though, is much older, that goes back centuries before the Common Era. And then, most important, Mark has just shared with us the research that shows that quarantine is effective.
40 giorno, right? Yep. 40 days. That's I know that from trying to buy fruit in the market in Padua. So 240 would be 240, and working on my Italian. That's great. And I love the historical reference as well. So, John, it's your turn to make a recommendation for our listeners.
Yes. A History of God by Karen Armstrong is my recommendation on this day after Easter and week after the Passover. It's an ambitious project by a former Catholic nun. This expansive book was a New York Times bestseller in 1993. This is not a religious book, however. It's a detailed historical account of the development of monotheism as manifest through the religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. She starts the narrative around 4000 BC, when hints of monotheism were emerging from the mostly polytheistic ancient Middle East. This is a fascinating account of the histories of these religions woven into the historical context of the times, and it includes discussion of the influences of Eastern religions on Western monotheism. I think this is a must-read for those interested in understanding the historical roots of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and the mutual influences of these religions on each other throughout the history up to modern times.
That's a great recommendation. I have heard of that book and have meant to read it for a long time, and I think I'm going to make that my big summer read. And another writer, professor at University of North Carolina, Bart Ehrman, E-H-R-M-A-N-N, he also has done some really good writing on the history of the early Christian church and its origins. And so I think there's one called The Historical Jesus, if I remember correctly. But yeah, Karen Armstrong, prize-winning author, great recommendation, A History of God. So everyone, stay safe, stay well. We'll be back next week with a COVID-19-focused primary care update, and then the following week back to our more normal set of poems. And please like us and rate us on iTunes. Tell your friends, spread the links. We'll see you in a week.